I'm calling the Senate Judiciary Committee for the 31st Legislature to order. Today is Friday, January 25th. Welcome, everyone. Let the record reflect the time is 1:32 p.m. Today we have present Vice Chair Senator Reinbold, Senator Machicki, welcome. And on my right, your left, we have Senator Schauer and Senator Keel. So thank you very much, and myself, Chair Hughes. I'd like to remind committee members and those in the audience to silence or turn off your cell phones, please. And the staff we have assisting us today, and for which we are very thankful, are Eileen and Taylor with Senate Records and Nancy with the LIO, so thank you very much. And my Senate Judiciary Committee aide for the Judiciary Committee this year is Buddy Witt. So thank you, Buddy, for your service. And I'd at this time like to give my fellow committee members, if they have a staff that's following this committee, a chance to introduce them. Senator Reinbold?
So the staff that will be working with me on this committee is my chief of staff, which is Jeannie Mungle. Vote.
Senator Machicki?
Thank you, and my chief of staff is also staffing this committee, and it's Lynn Smith in the back row.
And Senator Schauer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Cesar Martinson will be my Judiciary Committee aide for this session.
And Senator Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kathy Schlinghide tries to make me look smart on this committee.
Well, thank you. And we need all the help we can get, right? All of us. So.
Big lift in my case.
We have two items on today's agenda. The first, we'll hear a presentation from Nancy Mead, the Chief Counsel of the Alaska State Court System, and she'll be informing our committee of the processes and procedures of the Alaska court system. And following Ms. Mead, we'll hear a Senate Bill 8, Access to Marijuana Conviction Records, sponsored by Senator Begich. And we will hold an initial hearing on this bill and open public testimony today, but my intention, just so you know, is to hold the bill over. And so to get started, I'd like to invite Nancy Mead up to the table. And she knows the routine, but welcome. Please place your name on the record and tell us about the Alaska court system once you get situated.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Mead. I'm the general counsel for the Alaska court system. And as the chair said, I was asked to come today and provide a brief summary of basically the operations of the court system, how we're organized, and what we do. This is not a budget overview, even though the word overview is used. So that comes in finance, where many of you sit, and we'll hear it from my colleague. The budget for the court system is handled by Deputy Director Doug Wooliver. I handle the bills and issues related to that. So I know some of you are already quite familiar with how the court system works or served in on judiciary committees before, but I'll try to, I don't know, talk fast or make it non-boring or something. But so quickly, the court system is the primary component of the judicial branch of government, often called the third branch. We are a separate branch established in Article 4 of the Constitution. The judicial branch also has two other small components. One is the Alaska Judicial Council, and the other is the Commission on Judicial Conduct. They are not related to the court system in any way, but their work does certainly impact the court system. But for the judicial branch, the hugest piece of it is the Alaska court system. Article 4 of the Constitution establishes the courts as a unified court system, and what that means is, in terms of administration, there's one administrative office. It is in Anchorage. It's across from the Nesbitt Courthouse, and what happens administratively in that courthouse or in that administrative office has sway over the entire state. Every court responds to that one administrative office. In Alaska, we don't have any municipal courts. We don't have any borough courts. We don't have any subsidiary courts at all. If you get a ticket from a city police department, for example, Kenai Police Department, all those still go to the state court system. There is nothing underneath or different from that one court system, no borough courts. Our mission, paraphrased kind of loosely, is to provide an impartial forum for the just resolution of disputes. And let me take an aside right here. people sometimes confuse the lawyers in the criminal justice system and in the justice system as a whole and where they work. I, unlike pretty much everybody else that will appear in front of you, I do not work for the executive branch. So the lawyers in the Department of Law, that is the assistant attorney generals and the district attorneys, they work for the governor. The lawyers at the public defenders, the Office of Public Advocacy, they all work for the governor and the executive branch. I do not. I work directly for the Supreme Court and the administrative director of the court system. Because we are a separate branch of government and because we need to provide an impartial forum for dispute resolutions, I don't, in testimony or otherwise, opine about policy decisions. We respect the separation of powers. That is for your branch to make those policy decisions that will be reflected in the statutes. My job, as I view it, is to try to have the laws as clear as possible, to cut down on litigation about what you meant when you wrote a statute, and also to inform you about how a judge might read that law, how it might be applied, and the impacts it would have on the justice system. But again, I don't opine on the constitutionality or good or badness of any policy calls you might be making, except in very rare circumstances when something might directly impact the operations of the courts, and that does happen occasionally. Okay, so with that sort of backdrop, I'd like to jump into the basics. I want to give you a sense of our size. One of the documents that I believe you received ahead of time is a simple map. The map is entitled Alaska Court Locations, FY18, and it shows the four judicial districts. So with this, I just wanted to illustrate where we have a presence. There are 40 courthouse locations around the state. We own some of them. In 11 spots, we rent space from other buildings owned by the state. For example, the Juneau Court is part of a building that is owned by the executive branch. And in most of the sites, 27 of the 40, we rent those from municipalities, native organizations, private landlords, et cetera. In these locations where you see a dot is where we have a court. They are variously staffed. We don't have judges in all those locations, but we have a presence of some sort in a courthouse in each of those locations. So if we look, for example, at the 4th Judicial District, just as one of the examples, in Fairbanks and Bethel, the larger dots, that's where we have superior and district courts. But the other locations are variously staffed. For example, we have one circuit magistrate judge, which is a lower level judicial officer who travels between Aniak, Delta Junction, and Enana and covers the proceedings there on a rotating basis. We have a local magistrate judge in Hooper Bay and Ammonick. And we have deputy magistrates, which are even lower level. They are they started off as clerical staff who received training to cover certain types, limited types of proceedings. You can also, and that's true for all the courts here. They are staffed at different levels. You can also see from this map that the state is divided up into four judicial districts. And those judicial districts are each headed by one presiding judge. And the presiding judge is a superior court judge sitting in that district. And that presiding judge takes care of administrative matters for that district only. For example, some personnel or hiring things go through the presiding judge, ways to process cases more efficiently or effectively, maybe pilot programs, ideas that that presiding judge might have, how cases get assigned to the different judges. That's all up to the presiding judge. The presiding judges might, depending on the person, take a decreased caseload to because they have all these other additional administrative tasks. So that's where we have courts and how they're staffed generally. To cover these locations, we have 747 employees. That includes 73 judges and justices, and I'll talk about where they are in a moment. And though this isn't a budget talk, I will say we're down about 70 positions from where we were 3 years ago. And our budget is about $108 million, just to give you an idea of the size, and that represents 1.4% of all states of the state's budget. We get nearly all of our operating money from you through appropriation. We have a tiny amount of grants and intra-agency receipts, but it's largely just appropriation from the legislature. Any money we receive, so money that people might pay for filing fees for a case, for fines assessed for a misdemeanor, and they can pay at the courthouse, or a felony, minor offense fines like traffic tickets, et cetera, any money we get, bail forfeited, goes directly back into the general fund. It doesn't fund our operations. We don't keep it. We don't have any receipt authority. It's just not how it's done. So that's a little bit of who we are and our size. And let me move a little bit into the organization of the courts. And again, some of you are very familiar with this. There are three levels of courts in Alaska. We have the Alaska Supreme Court at the very highest. That it has five justices on it. The five justices elect among themselves one chief justice to serve a three-year term. The current chief justice is Joel Bulger. The Constitution says that they can serve more than one term, but not two consecutive terms. You'll meet him when he comes down for the State of the Judiciary in early February, and hopefully you'll come to the breakfast beforehand and be able to mingle a little bit. The Supreme Court sits primarily in Anchorage, and they travel to Fairbanks and Juneau a couple of times a year, depending on the cases. They try to hear the cases in the district in which the dispute arose. That doesn't always happen, but they try, so they might save up three or four or five Juneau appeals and hear them all at once on one trip, or the same for Fairbanks, et cetera. They also do occasional outreach and sit as a Supreme Court in one of the high schools. They've done that in Sitka, Fairbanks, Kenai last year. I think this year it's scheduled to be in West High School, and the students attend and learn an awful lot about civics and get prepared beforehand by lawyers, et cetera. The Supreme Court has jurisdiction over all appeals by right in civil cases. So even a divorce that starts in Superior Court, you have a right to appeal that directly to the Supreme Court. In criminal cases, they can take criminal cases by discretion because the court I'm about to talk about primarily deals with criminal appeals. This is an appellate court. There's no witnesses or anything like that, as you know. When they finish with the case, they issue a written decision. That's done after usually oral argument. The parties can opt to waive oral argument and have their case heard just on the briefs. Those written decisions are then published and fully available, and they are law. That's what you might have heard the term common law. Those are laws that are not in statute, but they are laws and just as binding nonetheless, the Supreme Court's opinions. They also have the ability to adopt court rules of practice and procedure and administration, and they do that. You might have seen around a very thick Alaska Rules of Court, and there's a set on all different subject areas. For example, there's the criminal rules of procedure, civil rules of procedure, China rules of procedure, appellate, probate, it goes on. And those are what the Supreme Court does. You can kind of think of it instead of regulations. Our branch doesn't have anything to do with regulations. That is something that the executive branch does to help them ferret out more detail after you guys pass a statute. Below the Supreme Court is the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals has three judges. They have jurisdiction over just criminal matters and related things. And I say related things because, like juvenile delinquency, they have jurisdiction over, and juvenile delinquency is not a criminal case. It's a juvenile case. It's just a different beast. They have jurisdiction over post-conviction relief cases, which are very vaguely, you can think of it almost like a habeas corpus, though that isn't really the legal way to look at it. But and those are they're criminally related. Sentencing appeals and merit appeals are the two main things they do. Merits, in other words, I shouldn't have been convicted, and sentences, okay, but I didn't like what my sentence was. So they handle those sorts of matters. The trial courts are divided into two different types of trial courts. So the trial courts are where you see most action within the court system. They have the highest, much higher caseloads, of course. Only a very small subset gets appealed either to the Court of Appeals or to the Alaska Supreme Court. The Superior Court is the court of general jurisdiction. Superior Court judges can handle any trial issue that might arise. Carved out of that is the district court. They can handle just a subset of those cases that the Superior Court judge can handle. A Superior Court judge has the bigger cases, the felonies, the child in need of aid cases, probate matters and domestic relations they handle, whereas the district court can only handle misdemeanors, civil cases only up to a certain dollar amount, it's $100,000. District court handles domestic violence petitions and things like that. And I'll get into exactly what they do in just a few moments. And here I'll just diverge a little bit into therapeutic courts since I often get questions about those. Therapeutic courts are a special problem-solving court that we operate in six different locations around the state. Some of those locations have more than one court. For example, Anchorage has four therapeutic courts. Mostly in those six locations, and those locations are Juneau, Kenai, Anchorage, Palmer, Fairbanks, and Bethel. They all have a sometimes called wellness court, sometimes called therapeutic court. The terminology is inconsistent, unfortunately. A court that deals with DUI and drugs, misdemeanor and felonies. Some of those therapeutic courts, some of those locations also have a mental health court. And we also have a veterans court in Anchorage, and we have a new-ish family-type court for people involved in the child in need of aid world who also have some addiction issues, and I think they have to have a child under 36 months or something, and the idea is to early intervene and solve people's problems before they become even larger. So the therapeutic courts, as you probably know, the goal is to identify defendants whose involvement with the criminal justice system stems from underlying problems of either addiction to alcohol or controlled substances, or stems from mental health disorders. Sometimes, often, those coexist. And the idea of these courts is to address those underlying causes in an attempt to then stop the criminality that's occurring with this individual. Those problems are very difficult to solve, as we as a state recognize, but these programs are very intense. They're also, by the way, quite expensive and resource intensive. Those who do graduate, and many drop out, those who do graduate end up recidivating or reoffending, committing a new crime at about a third lower rate than those who have not gone through the programs. Those therapeutic courts take a lot of coordination and interagency collaboration. So for one therapeutic court, you not only need a judge, you need a district attorney who's dedicated to that court, a public defender or defense counsel for that individual, a probation officer, social services providers. So we're talking court system, Department of Law, Department of Administration folks, Department of Health and Social Services, and Department of Corrections, at least, all working together to resolve an individual's issues that led to the criminality. The person has to volunteer for this setup, and people have to agree that they're an appropriate candidate for a therapeutic court. And in exchange for going through it, they will end up with some benefit, like lower jail time or less of a fine for doing that. And so at this point, I'll also say that that is one example of collaboration and cooperation that the court works with other agencies on. We work with the other agencies and really depend on the work of the other agencies in many other areas, not just cases, but for example, there's a criminal justice working group that's been underway for a good number of years, and that involves actually the Chief Justice and high-level people from all the agencies involved in criminal justice, and the goal there is to identify operational issues, problems, hurdles, barriers, and try to address them in an open environment to make things run a little bit more smoothly. Another example is the Supreme Court recently appointed a guardianship committee. We have an aging population, and we have more and more guardianship cases. So judges and court staff and people from Office of Public Advocacy and the Elder Law Office, all sorts of people get together and try to solve these problems. There's a federally funded court improvement project aimed at child in need of aid cases, and that involves public defenders, and anyhow, you get the idea. We work on many committees with many other parts and people involved in state government. Okay, let me turn to the other chart that I handed out, which is the colored pie chart. I'm sorry.
Yes, Senator Reinbold has a question. Senator Reinbold.
Okay, so yesterday the Criminal Justice Commission met, and today the working group is meeting. And I'm wondering, how do they correlate their work?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, the Criminal Justice Commission was established in statute in 2016, and the statute carefully sets out who's on the commission and what their duties and tasks are, and it names who can name the certain people on the commission. And their job was to do a study of criminal justice issues top to bottom and solve them. And make recommendations to help you make decisions about how to address those. The Criminal Justice Working Group has been ongoing for many years. In some years, it's gone into a little bit of a hiatus for different reasons. But they do more operational issues. They'll talk about how is this being implemented? Can the public defender help you, court, in implementing this little project? Or, you know, how's the pilot project going in Fairbanks or in Juneau when we weren't getting, you know, discovery appropriately? We tried to do this electronic thing. Let's just all work together to solve problems that are much, much more operational than structural, I think I'd say.
Through the chair,
follow up.
Okay, so they're completely separate.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, they are separate, but as it happens, they have a lot of the same people on them because the justice happens to be the same individual who's serving on both. The attorney general is on both, I believe. The commissioners of DPS, DOC, et cetera, are on both. So there is some crossover.
Okay, thank you. Proceed.
Okay. I'd like to turn to the pie chart sheet that I showed you, and here's where I'm going to talk about probably all you were interested in, which is our workload and case filings and then what happens with these case filings. So what this shows is what we do in a given year. This is FY18, and I'll tell you what the trends have been after we talk about this one-year snapshot kind of thing of what we've seen. This on the top are both trial courts combined. So the circle on the top is really a combination of the two circles on the bottom. The top is superior and district courts combined. You can see that about a quarter of the work, 29%, is civil, about a quarter criminal, a whole lot of the rest, almost half, is minor offenses, and then children's is a little bit. But the better picture that you can get is by looking at the individual court. So I'd like to talk about the superior court filings. That's in the lower left of the piece of paper that you're looking at. This is a pie chart showing what we did that year. So again, it might be surprising to know that 20% of the case filings are probate cases. Probate cases are mental commitment cases, which is the biggest chunk of that 6,800 cases, and also guardianship and conservatorship cases. And those are cases where somebody is unable to appropriately take care of their own affairs, and the court has to appoint somebody to assist them with that. I will also say that these pie charts show the number of cases filed in those areas. They do not necessarily reflect the amount of work that a court does in those areas. Some of those probate cases don't take as long as, for example, a felony case, but it's still 28% of our filing numbers. The felony, 30% of the Superior Court's caseload, the 7,186 cases, those include the definition of a felony classically has been anything punishable by 1 year or more in jail. And so those are the larger cases that you're probably most aware of when it comes to crime. Although if you skip over for a moment and let your eye look at how many misdemeanors we have, it's many, many more. 21,000 misdemeanors, those are displayed on the district court side because that's who handles those. So we had 7,186 felonies. In connection with that, we also handled 5,000 petitions to revoke probation, what are called by most people in the system the PTRPs. These are people who have served their time, their sentence time, if they had sentence time, and were put on felony probation, and then for one reason or another needed to be brought back in front of the court for not complying with the conditions of probation. So in some ways I say that because that number of felonies doesn't tell the whole story about what we really are seeing with those, because with those 5,000 that comes back with a petition to revoke, there is, again, the person is entitled to counsel and kind of the it can start rolling again. Now, those are obviously resolved much faster than the underlying felony case, but nonetheless, that's what we have.
Nancy, just interrupt here for a second. So the 5,000 petition to revoke, that falls under the blue, the felony in the pie chart?
They aren't reflected in the pie chart.
Oh, they aren't reflected. Thank you.
Right. They receive the same case number as the underlying felony, but they're just an extension of it. I guess I'd point that out. You can see that domestic relations cases is about 18%. Those encompass divorce cases, which you would think of course, child custody cases, and those are separate if the parents were unmarried, child support cases where people wonder how much pay they should get from the non-custodial parent. And those cases actually take an awful lot of time. One of the reasons is those cases often don't end until a child becomes 18 years of age. So after a case might be semi-resolved or resolved and a decree is issued, they can come back and come back and come back, and they often do, with motions to modify. And those motions to modify, we had about 1,400 of those last year. That is, yes, you said this would be the custody arrangement, but I need a change because of this reason, or this would be the support, but I want it changed because of this reason. So those can continue for years and years and years, actually.
And I'll interrupt again. So those 1,400, is that in addition to what's
in there? Correct. That's correct. They just it would come later. You can see the CINA, the red, that's what everyone calls China cases. If you're not used to it, you wonder what that means. Those are the child in need of aid cases where the state has interceded in a family to say that there is a problem with neglect or abuse. Those cases also take an awful long time and a lot of court effort. Involved in those cases are, you know, children, parents. Parents might have separate lawyers and do have separate lawyers. There might be grandparents involved, other family members, tribes, guardians for the children. Guardians ad litem might be appointed. So those are quite labor intensive. Delinquency is just what it sounds like, juvenile delinquency. Those are not criminal cases, as I mentioned. The child is not ever considered guilty of a crime, but rather adjudicated as a delinquent minor, different terminology with different goals in delinquency. The district attorney doesn't prosecute delinquency cases. Rather, the Division of Juvenile Justice follows those through the system. And then you can see general civil cases, about 2,500, just 10% of the caseload. Okay, moving over to the district court filings. The 98,000 cases, I must clarify and should have earlier, when it says minor offenses, it basically means you can think of those as things charged on a citation. So those are mostly traffic tickets or fish and game tickets. There are other tickets as well, but they aren't cases involving minors or children, which some people think the first time that they hear that terminology. So we have most of our cases are minor offenses, but also those are the fastest to process. They are almost all, I'm not sure the percentage now, but 70%, I would guess, filed electronically with the court. So when you get pulled over, the officer has a handheld computer device that auto-transmits the citation. So that is the beginning of, you know, an electronic system of getting information to the court with the charge. Misdemeanors is obviously the big thing that the district court does. Misdemeanors are classically defined as things punishable by a year or less in jail. They are often a lot of work for the district court, but often they resolve easily with a plea bargain early on in the case. And I'll get to how these cases are disposed in just one moment. The 8% there are domestic violence. And I want to clarify that these are civil domestic violence protective order petitions. These aren't domestic violence crimes. They aren't criminal cases. They would be included as either the felony or the misdemeanor. But these are when a citizen wants to get an order of protection against a respondent, another citizen. The district attorney and the Department of Laws are not involved in domestic violence protection orders. You can also see that their general civil load is about 8%, small claims being 6% of that. So those are the district court filings. Let me talk a few moments about the dispositions. These numbers won't match because I also have the numbers, how cases were ended. That's what dispositions
are. Can I ask you to pause for a moment?
Yep.
I'm just wondering, we have general civil in both, and I know it has to do with a dollar amount. What's the dollar cutoff so that it goes over to the superior court?
If more than $100,000 in controversy goes to the Superior Court, if it's less than $100,000 in controversy, it's a district court matter. And the subset of that is less than $10,000, I believe, is the jurisdictional limit for small claims. Small claims just has relaxed rules, few lawyers.
Okay, thank you.
Also, there are some permutations. If somebody wants equitable relief, it must go to Superior Court, even if the dollar amount is low. That is, if they want the court to force somebody to do something by court order.
Okay, thank you. Proceed.
Okay. The way these cases are disposed, let me talk about that. And this will be just for the criminal cases. So if you look at our felonies on the Superior Court, those 7,186 cases, last year, out of the cases that were filed or that were ended in 2018, about 65% of those were resolved with a guilty plea. So that is a plea bargain. In FY18, about 32.5% were dismissed outright. And that leaves only about 1% or 2% that went to trial. In fact, we had 138 felony trials during FY18.
Nancy, the 32.5% that are dismissed, is there any breakdown as to the reason why they were dismissed?
To the chair, I don't have the breakdown with me. I had done that for a prior year once. It's actually a lot of work for our staff to figure that out, and I will do it if you wish. But the vast majority is dismissed by the prosecutor, who comes in later and says, we dismissed the case for whatever reason.
Okay, thank you.
There are a handful dismissed by the court for maybe timing problems or upon a motion for an illegal search and seizure or something like that. But off the top of my head, and this isn't accurate, maybe 30% are dismissed by the prosecutor, and a few percent are dismissed for other reasons.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and the same information for the misdemeanors on the district court side. Out of those, well, it wasn't 21,000 dispositions we had, but there we had. Let me see if I can find it. I can't read my writing, but okay, there was less than 1% of trials, 129 misdemeanor trials, 56% were disposed with a dismissal, and about 42%, I think I have those switched, 42% dismissed and 56% were a plea bargain. Sorry about that. And those numbers have changed over the years. The dismissals and the plea bargains are dependent on lots of different complicated factors interrelating, having to do really with priorities of the Department of Law, for one thing, and funding, and lots of other reasons that those dispositions could happen that way. And now, let me talk a little about trends that we've seen over the years. That's exactly what happened in FY18.
Senator Reinbold has a question.
Can you describe just misdemeanor A's and misdemeanor B's and, you know, just some high level. And I know Senate Bill 91 took misdemeanor A significantly down. I believe it was from 1 year to 30 days. And the misdemeanor B's, I believe, was 6 months down to 10 days. But I'm just wondering, that is a amazing number of dismissals, almost 50% of the cases. So I really think this is worthy of first describing what misdemeanor A's and B's are, and then just knowing, is it just because there's no, this is what I've heard, is that it's just not worth their time, the prosecutor's time, because they only go to jail for a week and they're going to go through all this, so just let all these criminals off. So it's very frustrating out there on the streets, and people want answers. They want to know why.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, although I, as the court, can't address why a case would be dismissed by the prosecutor, charging decisions are solely in the discretion of the prosecutor's office. A court cannot dismiss a case as being improvidently charged or for any other reason like that. But I can generally tell you that A, misdemeanors are punishable by, after SB 91 current law, it's the 30 days is the maximum days in jail as a default. However, SB 91 in AS 1255-135A, that's where the A misdemeanor penalties are, has a number of exceptions to that. One is assault in the fourth degree, which is a very common A misdemeanor. Others are A misdemeanors related to online sexual offenses. Those can all be charged up to a year. And if it's your second A misdemeanor or more, it can be, I said charged, but I meant sentenced up to a year. So that's how A misdemeanors work very generally. Now, B misdemeanors, which is in subsection B of that same statute, currently are punishable by a maximum of 10 days in jail. And you are correct, it did used to be 90 days in jail as the default, with, again, some exceptions listed in that statute for things that can be punishable by longer time periods.
I'll follow up, Senator Rybold.
Can you give some examples of A misdemeanors and B misdemeanors?
Through the chair, Senator Rybold, this is not my strength, frankly, but the Department of Law would be much better at reciting these. As I say, the most common A misdemeanor that I'm aware of is assault in the fourth degree, which is often the fear assault. That is, you put somebody in fear of physical injury. B misdemeanors I'm afraid if I speak, I might be incorrect. So I don't think I can provide that right now. I'm sorry, Senator.
And Senator Rybold, I'd actually made a note when I asked the question about why the dismissals that we would ask just briefly Casey Schroeder with the Department of Law, if she could shed some light on those dismissals. So we'll bring her up afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, let me just make sure I didn't misspeak about the dispositions of misdemeanors. It is a 56% were guilty pleas and 42%. I'm not sure if I said that or if I mixed them up or said both. So that is the answer. And just about a couple percent go to trial. Okay, with the chair's permission, I'd like to talk about the trends, what we've seen over the last 10 years in these case filing numbers.
And before that, Senator Michiki has a question.
I'm sorry. You said that 56% resulted in a guilty plea and 42% were dismissed. Was 42% the number that you...
That is what I said. My chart says 42.9, so I probably should have said 43%, okay. But yes.
And Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could you repeat those same three numbers on the felonies, less than 1%?
About 1% to 2% go to trial. Mm-hmm. I'm rounding a little bit. The guilty pleas for felonies were 65%, ended that way. And the dismissals for felonies, 32.5%, our data shows.
Thank you very much.
And again, the court does collect statistics, but we aren't tasked with, and we can't tell why these numbers are these way. This is just what we see. And as I move into some of the trends and what we've seen over the last 10 years, maybe it'll be equally dissatisfying because I can tell you what we see, but not really why. And we don't really track trends. That isn't part of our mission. But to collect this, I just looked at our data from the last 10 years and we put it together. Sometimes it's not that hard to do, but we do that if we're having to make resource decisions or something, so we can collect trends. So let me focus on the Superior Court, the bigger cases that you probably care about an awful lot. The main thing that I can tell you about the filings in Superior Court is that they were higher than any other year, so they are rising. And they have been rising sort of steadily, but that 24,048 number on top of all Superior Court cases filed is the highest we've ever seen. This is driven largely by the subset of felonies, which also hit a record high in FY18 for case filings, the 7,186. Felony filings stayed in the 6,000s for all the years before FY18. And in FY17, for example, there were 6,200, and in FY18, 7,200. That's a substantial jump and a substantial change in the number of felony cases that we've seen. And in fact, that 7186 is 500 more than any other year that we've had. So that was a substantial jump. The child in need of aid cases also increasing. the 2,500, it has been steady for a couple of years. I would say that increase came in about FY15. There had been about 1,800, 1,700, 1,800, 1,700 very suddenly. In FY15, that jumped to about 2,500. It's held about steady since then. Delinquency cases have been gradually going down just about every year of the last 10 years. Again, I don't know exactly why, but they are always dropping just a few every year. In FY10, there were 1,200. Now we have 750, so they have gone down. Domestic relations cases have also gone down, kind of steadily, but at a very slow rate. That 4,300 was 5,400 10 years ago. General civil cases have remained steady kind of always. That's just a steady piece of the pie. Probate cases are always growing. They've never had a step back year. Our population is aging. Our population over age 65 in 2010 was 55,000 people. Alaska's population over age 65 now is 83,000 people. And again, those guardianships and conservatorships where somebody is appointed, either public or privately, to help somebody manage their affairs is the main area where that has been growing. And one more thing I'll do in the trends, and that is break apart the felonies by the type of felony. Our annual report organizes this information the way the statutes organize this information. So I can talk about the felonies in about five different categories. The first is crimes against a person.
Excuse me, we'll interrupt you again for a question from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Mead, stepping back to the probate cases, do those also include probate and wills, and how do those compare proportionally to the guardianships and conservatorships?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, those do include probating wills. They're a very small piece of probate, even though that's what most people think of as probate cases. I can get you the exact numbers later. All these numbers, by the way, are in our annual report, which is published on our website, and you can look at them all. But I will get you that precise page.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Proceed.
Okay. Thank you. So breaking apart those felonies, the biggest category of the 7,186 felony cases were crimes against the person. Those are what we consider 1141 crimes, just because that's the title and chapter of the statutes that sets out all the crimes against persons. That number was the highest ever, 2569. That was about 400 more than the year before it. And again, these are just case filings. I sometimes hear the caution in those Criminal Justice Commission and working group meetings that this should not be used as evidence of the crime rate, because these are just the ones that end up filed with the court. The court doesn't know anything about arrest rates or reports of crime or anything like that. But anyhow, we had 2569 crimes against a person, and those would include, of course, homicides, assaults, sexual assaults, things of that nature. Okay. The next biggest were the property crimes. This also was the highest ever. So the felonies were the highest ever, the crimes against the person were the highest ever, and the crimes against property were highest ever. And those are what you would think of: theft, burglary, robbery, vehicle theft, arson, criminal mischief, criminal trespass. There were 2501 in FY18 property crimes filed. I'm also going to pause and say that many cases have more than one charge. If a person is involved in a criminal incident, they often broke more than one of your statutes. We categorize the case and put it where the most severe level is. So if somebody's charged with a property crime and a DUI, for example, and a misdemeanor DUI, we call that a property crime case, just for consistency.
Senator Reinfeld has a question.
Thank you. That sounds a little lower than what I was expecting in regards to the property crime. Just pointing out just the vehicle theft alone in Anchorage, I saw numbers that were bigger than that. Is it because people don't file cases, or?
Through the chair, Senator Reinfeld, that could be, and I'm not sure what number you're thinking of in your head, but this is the number of property case filings felony. So that would be, at this point, it's anything with stolen with a value of $750 or greater is a property felony, generally speaking. But all vehicle thefts are also felonies, and so they would be included in that. And I'm not sure what number you've seen before, but again, these are just what comes into the court system.
Follow up? Or is that it? Okay. Did you have a question, Senator Schauer?
I mentioned that part of that. I was looking at those statistics. Mm-hmm. Many of those vehicles stolen were by the same people, so they often end up in the same docket, if you will. So it's not like they're charged for every single one. Just some of them were like 50. I mean, they were significant.
Bingo. Thank you. You answered the question. Thanks.
And through the chair, senators, you might want to clarify that with the Department of Law, how that would work. I don't have a full understanding of that, but that could be that could probably be clarified. The third category of felonies are the felony drug crimes. We had the lowest numbers of those in FY17 and 18. There were only 371 cases in FY18. That compares in FY16, there were 1,000 cases. In FY17, 330. So a huge drop between FY16 and FY17.
Interrupt? Wouldn't that be because the simple possession would no longer fall under here? So that's a drop from the 1,000 to the 371.
And through the chair, that could well be. Again, I hesitate to say why, but that is not an illogical conclusion as to why there were fewer at that point in time. I mean, that did happen at the same time.
So we can't assume by that drop that the drug problem's going away, is my point. Thank you.
Yes, okay, so that was the lowest except for FY17, so 18 and 17 were low. DUI is the next largest category. There were 276 felony DUIs. Of course, your first two DUIs, generally speaking, there's a time frame where they're counted and not counted, are misdemeanors, and by the time you get to felony DUI, it's your third or greater within the last, 10 years. So there were 276 of those. And that has fluctuated somewhat, but for comparison, in FY10, there were 577. So again, I would caution as to why the numbers vary, but I don't think that you could validly conclude it reflects the amount of times these things are happening in the world, but is more impacted by resources and decisions about what charges to bring and what cases to file. The other categories in the felonies are not as common. There are offenses against public order, and people wonder what that means, but again, it's what the statutes are called, and those are things like riot and disorderly conduct and gangs and things like that. So the public order ones are small. There's about 100. They're steady. Weapon charges, there's about 240. They're rising, and we did have the highest ever, but that's also a very small number, so I don't know how statistically significant saying they're the highest ever. So that's about what we see in the felony filing trends. And I could provide more in terms of, you know, probate trends, but I tried to give kind of what would be of most interest at this point without being too tedious. So those are our case filings. They're the trends that we're seeing. And I just wanted to mention a couple more things in my presentation. And that is, as I already mentioned, how we work with the other agencies very closely. We have those rules committees. And I want to talk just for a moment about the other ways we touch the public. We summoned 24,000 jurors in FY18. So that's a lot of people that had some contact with the court system. Whether they reported and actually had to serve as jurors is a different question. There were about 3,500 summoned for grand jury. We hold grand juries in 12 different locations around the state. Fewer than 300 trials happened. But the cost of those jurors is not insignificant. We not only give the $25 a day, which might be what you're thinking of if you live in a big community as not being terribly expensive, but in outlying communities where we summon jurors, we also have to pay them travel costs, including transportation, food, and lodging. So places like Bethel and Dillingham have extremely high juror costs to the tune of about $1.5 million last year. We work on summoning jurors appropriately and efficiently. There's a jury management committee working on things like online questionnaires and assessing the most effective use of jurors without disturbing the public more than we need to in order to get the job done. And one kind of last thing is that the court system touches people in many ways, the people who get tickets and pay their minor offenses online, people who just come through our door. I think some information I have is like 32,000 people walk through the front doors of the Anchorage Courthouse per month at one point last year. In Palmer, it's about 6,500 per month coming through the front doors. So we really have a lot of people touch the court system and walk in and use our services or are unhappily in the court system for whatever reason. But that's how we work. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I hope I talked about the issues that the chair invited me to address.
All right. It looks like, is this a short question? Because we do have the hearing.
I hope so, Madam Chair.
Okay, so go ahead. And do any other members have questions? Okay.
To the question of jurors, through the chair, 24,000 summoned, about 300 trials. So 14 a trial. That's six times as many summoned as you tend to need. What's the overarching goal? To never miss a day, or to inconvenience as few Alaskans as possible? That seems like a lot.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that's actually a great question. When I say we're summoned, I say they received the notice in the mail. They did not necessarily have to show up. We are constantly trying to not waste people's time, balanced against moving the trials along and having people show up for jury service. So the people, 24,000 people had to call in. But not 24,000 people did not have to transport themselves to a courthouse to see if they would serve.
Do we have that number?
Through the chair, I probably can get that number.
Okay. And Senator Schauer, did you have a quick question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that time is tight, so just kind of a generic question, and it's a little bit of opinion from you, Nancy, on this one. Resources do your job. I know we spoke a couple nights ago about this. There is the perception that the system overall is getting bogged down a bit, and I know you were saying that you don't believe that's in the court system per se, but perhaps prosecutors, other areas. In that question with the budget, are you in a good place to do your job? Do you need more or less resources? And I understand this kind of gets a little bit of opinion, but just if you would just tell us, because budget's going to be a problem. We all know it. It's coming. So what's your opinion of where you sit, and do you foresee needing more or less to be able to do the job that you have been asked to do in our criminal justice system?
And through the chair, Senator Schauer, we are, as the senators know, proactive about our budget and trying to only seek exactly what we need to get our job done. This year, we have asked for a small increment in our operating budget because of rising unavoidable utility costs. Actually, I don't know the exact amount of that increment. And we have a couple of capital requests as well. So that budget reflects the Supreme Court's and the Administrative Director's determination that with those funds, we can fully and adequately do what we are supposed to be doing. Now, I will also say that with 70 fewer positions, we have a level of staffing right now that is minimal and bare bones, but gets the job done. Now, with 70 fewer positions, we're doing a little bit less than we used to be able to do. We strive to make that little bit less not very visible to the public. And for example, four people are now doing a job that six people used to do, because when two people left, we were unable to fill those positions. So people are hustling around a little bit more behind the scenes. We are not holding criminal trials. If the parties are ready for a criminal trial, the court has been committed to providing a judge on that day. So we are trying and believe we're doing a great job at not being the bottleneck in moving things forward. But clearly with fewer resources, we're maybe getting behind in filing and entering things into CourtView, and that may be frustrating to people who are looking up information on CourtView, for example. So I guess in short, we're trying our best not to have that visible to the public. We don't think we're having an impact on the pace of criminal cases, which is what most people are concerned about.
Thank you.
All right, and I'm glad to hear what you said, because I had heard that there was a backlog of criminal, and it sounds like you are keeping up with that, so that's good news. And I'm going to move on to Senator Michiki.
So two questions, Ms. Mead. One is, there's a very good probability that our criminal justice laws are amended this year, which is likely going to result in a higher caseload. Is your department evaluating potential impacts as that budget is put together? That's the first question I have.
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, we didn't see a big case drop with the latest big round of changes to our criminal laws. We had kind of a zero fiscal note on that, and I think we might, depending on what's in those bills exactly, if something like that passed, also be able to react to those changing caseloads.
Second question, ma'am.
Senator Michiki, yes, go ahead.
One of the problems we're having on the Kenai is that we, in the wee hours of the morning when someone is picked up, a judge is not available. Just wondering if that's something the court systems are looking at. In fact, in many cases, people are released, even though they might have wanted to get them before a judge for certain crimes.
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, I actually was not aware of that. We have judges, I thought, on call everywhere for bail setting, if that's the issue that you're concerned with. Now, there is a bail schedule, and law enforcement can release people for certain misdemeanors only, and not DV and not other things, under a bail schedule without contact with a judicial officer. But my understanding is that we did have judicial officers available for any time that a deviation from that schedule is, or somebody wants bail, and I will specifically look into Kenai and get back to you.
And thank you. And with that, if you have further questions, you can submit them to my office, and we'll get them to Nancy. Thank you very much. And I know our time is limited. And Casey, you were not here to ask some of the questions that arose. So if you want to get back with the committee on those, because of the time, I think that would be better. But the questions, just so you have them, that if you could speak to the dismissals, the 32.5% for the felonies and the 42% for the misdemeanors. And also there was a question about vehicle theft and if we have multiples being grouped together. And then if you could also speak, this one we didn't talk about, but it's my question, is regarding the drop in DUIs, if you might be able to give us some background why that might be happening, because it sounds like they're just happening just as frequently, but they're not coming to the court. So with that, Senator Michiki, did you have another question?
What? No, Madam Chair, what I wanted to say is I think this is one of the reasons that when other states have changed their criminal justice laws, similar to Senate Bill 91, that they have reported lower crime rates. And I think it's important that we understand that with DUI being a violation now, I think there's a connection between the two. So I'm glad you're asking that question.
Yes, thank you very much. And thank you, Nancy. We appreciate you being here today. And so at this time, I'm going to invite Senator Begich and his prime staffer, Sidney Linneman, to the table. And as we know, Senator Begich is the minority leader in the Senate, and he's going to introduce Senate Bill 8 today, Access to Marijuana Conviction Records. This was heard in a previous legislature by the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I believe at least one member heard it on the Senate side. And so we wanted to give him a chance to present this today, and I believe Senator Begich is aware, but I want everyone to know that we have Kathy Monfreda from Department of Public Safety online available for questions. And then in the room we have Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law
And Nancy Mead is also from sticking around, and as you know, she is from the court system. So, Senator Begich, welcome to Senate Judiciary, and I'll ask you to tell us about our bill. We did post public testimony on this. My intention, as I announced at the beginning, is to hold this bill over, but let's be cognizant of the time because our discussion can – I want to make sure we give the public a chance to weigh in, and so discussion maybe have to continue a different time. So go ahead and
thank you,
state
Madam
your name
Chair.
For the record and proceed.
My name is Senator Tom Begich. I am the state senator for District J in downtown Anchorage, and I am, as you pointed out, the minority leader for the body. The to my right is Dr. Sidney Linneman, who is my staff assistant chief of staff and has been working with this bill throughout the process. As you pointed out, I want to first thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing this bill today and for bringing it before the committee. This bill was before the Judiciary Committee, as you pointed out, last year, and did pass through this committee with the support of the committee. SB 8 is identical to that version of the bill that passed out last time. This bill would essentially restrict the release of certain criminal records for conviction related to the possession of marijuana, which is a B misdemeanor in the law. These are crimes that today would no longer be criminal based on our legalization of marijuana that occurred some years ago. The original bill was brought to me by a constituent who works on employment issues out of the Mountain View Library. He witnessed people coming up to the computer terminals they had who would leave, and he finally asked them why. Why are you know, not completing your forms? And it was because they believed they couldn't get employment or housing options that were provided through that computer program because of some of the questions on background checks, because of a single prior conviction related to a crime that is no longer a crime today. Employment and housing issues are critical also to not just my district but throughout the state due to homelessness issues and other issues where people really truly find themselves unable to get into housing or to get into a job because of a single mistake that they made that, again, is not a crime today. This bill would simply take those convictions off court view and certain background checks that would occur for employment and housing. Any background check that would happen to the Department of Public Safety under this bill would have to be requested by the person who committed the initial offense or the record holder, and that responsibility thus would fall on them to have to do it. It's not the state proactively doing it. It's about us putting the responsibility on the person. Finally, those records would still be available for any criminal justice search, any employment check to work in the medical field or working with kids or dependent adults. Doesn't put those populations at all of those areas of work would be covered in the sense that you could still look at the criminal record in those cases. I've worked with the Department of Law, Public Safety, the court systems, with nonprofit providers, worked especially because these are the issues, employment and housing, that critically come up time and time again for effective reentry programs and ensuring people don't come back into the criminal justice system. So the governor the other day spoke about opportunities for hope and success. And I think this is one of those opportunities that we can provide the people of Alaska. Over 700 people are covered presently from 2007 on up to when the marijuana was legalized would be covered by this. Alaskans today, and I know that you'll have questions, but I do want to get to the public testimony, and I'm just going to ask Dr. Linneman to go over the sectional analysis and talk about some of the changes we've already discussed for a committee substitute.
And before you begin, Sidney, I just want to recognize that Representative Hopkins has joined us in the audience. Proceed, Sidney.
For the record, Sidney Linneman, staff to Senator Begich. In going through this sectional analysis this afternoon, I'm going to highlight a few of the proposed changes we've discussed with the Departments of Law, Public Safety, and the court system. Senator Begich is wholly supportive of these changes and has submitted them, Madam Chairwoman, to your office for your consideration. I'm happy to try and answer some of the questions related to those changes, but I am not a lawyer, so I may punt to the experts when the time comes. So beginning with Section 1 describes the legislative intent to reduce barriers to reentry for those convicted of low-level marijuana possession, which would no longer be considered a crime today. In this section, We would clarify on line 9 certain types of background checks. At present, it just says a criminal history background check, because many of the background checks would not be covered by this bill. This would just be for an interested party. So if I was applying for a job at a supermarket, or if I were a landlord looking into someone's background, those would be rescinded. But if I were a prosecutor, I'd still be able to see those records. Section 2 prohibits the Department of Public Safety and any designated reporting agency from disclosing any criminal record associated with the possession of less than 1 ounce of a Scheduled 6A controlled substance conviction, covering both state statutes and municipal ordinances, if requested by the criminal record holder. So this prohibition would not include any search related to the criminal justice field, as Senator Begich described. These cases will be protected from disclosure only if a marijuana possession is the only crime for which the person was convicted associated with a particular record. Schedule 6A controlled substance is considered to be one with the lowest level of danger to users, and at present, marijuana is the only Schedule 6A drug. And a suggestion from the Department of Law and Courts and Public Safety was to replace notwithstanding on line 12 with in a request under, just for clarification. So section 3 would limit the Alaska court system's records of a criminal case involving convictions for possession less than 1 ounce of marijuana on court view. And the departments have requested, in order to ease their ability to transfer records between them, that we remove the word confidential in section 3. So that would be replaced by similar language that was found in Representative Drummond's bill, which passed the House last year, which contained a similar section, but just removes defining the records as confidential. But again, would restrict them from being available on court view, but would allow those three departments to transfer them in between.
I just want to interrupt. My understanding, too, the problem with that word confidential is the court wouldn't be able to even release them to the Department of Public Safety. So that's an important fix. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. And Section 4 indirectly amends the Alaska court system rules of administration by limiting access to these certain court records. So that would also, in that section, you'd also want to remove the word confidential. Section 5, because Section 4 indirectly amends the court rule, the legislation will require a two-thirds vote as described by the Alaska Constitution. And Section 6 provides 120 days for the legislation to take effect after the bill signing, giving the courts as well as affected agencies time to change their reporting protocols. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Senator Begich.
Madam Chair, so we bring this bill before you. We understand that there's work to be done. We have in the audience, as we mentioned, there's public testimony, but there's also testimony from the court system and I think Department of Public Safety. So thank you very much, Madam Chairman and members of the committee, for allowing us to present this piece of legislation.
Okay, and if you'll just hold, we may not have the discussion for this, but I want to get it on the record so that you're aware of some other concerns that I was wondering about. If you look on page 1 of the bill, lines 6 and 7, in the legislative intent, and you mentioned it's the intent of the legislature to reduce barriers to employment, and then the sectional analysis, there's the line that says these cases will be protected from disclosure only if marijuana possession is the only crime, and I'm emphasizing that, for which the person was convicted in a particular criminal case. Again, my emphasis. So if you look on the bill, in two places, it states, on page 2, lines 3 and 12, it says, was not convicted of any other charges in that case. So we're talking about a particular case. And so if we're limiting the application of the restriction of records to particular cases where the possession is the only crime resulting in a conviction, I think this ignores the fact that an existing criminal history involving other crimes would remain a barrier to employment for that person. So my question, if the intent to reduce barriers to employment is why you're bringing this forward, or housing, for people who have been convicted of a low-level misdemeanor marijuana possession,
then what is the rationale for ignoring the rest of their criminal history when that history of prior convictions of other crimes is already a barrier? In other words, could we not reduce the number of people that would even move forward and could have this removed as you're suggesting?
Well, if I might answer, Madam Chair, Senator Tom Begich. First, if the only crime they've ever committed was a marijuana crime, and that particular case had nothing else associated with it, then they would be cleared from court view. If they had any prior record, they'd still be on court view, and they would not be subject. I mean, they may have that one crime removed, but they would still have whatever prior crimes existed still on there. If you're asking, should we have made it broader, I don't think.
No, I think you're missing. Yeah. That person who gets that one removed still has other convictions on there which are going to be barriers. So why have that person lumped into someone that can get that pulled off if the point is to remove barriers for employment and housing?
Again, Madam Chair, I'm not quite sure I'm getting where you're going with that. And again, this is Tom Begich for the record. If you're saying that a person who's committed a number of crimes, including a one-time case with marijuana, would then have that cleared and they get the benefit of that clearing, is that what you're saying? You're arguing that clearance may not be – they may not be worthy of that clearance. Is that
– I'm not saying the person's not worthy of the clearance. I'm saying why bother clearing that if they have other things in their criminal history, other charges, because then it's not really – doing what you're proposing, removing barriers.
I understand now what you're asking for, and frankly, I would say that there's probably no reason why we wouldn't accept what you're suggesting, which is that they would be removed from the list of the 700 plus. I don't know the exact number that would then entail, but I'm certain that we could discover that.
And as follow-up, and I'll just throw this out because this is a much larger discussion, so that if any other members have something before we move to public testimony, in the materials, or at least in our discussion, you mentioned other states, and Vermont was one of them that could have this removed by petition. But when we looked up what Vermont requires, it in addition to petitioning, you could only be eligible if it's been 5 years since completing your sentence, you paid all restitution. Of course, that's probably not going to be the case. Or it's been 10 years since completing your sentence if you were later convicted of another crime and you've not been convicted of, well, it would be any other prior record, basically, and any restitution for any crime paid. So the bar there was a little bit higher than simply petitioning it. So the question is, would you be open to raising the bar to make sure that the people have been clean? I'm trying to remember when the marijuana legalization passed. Was that 2015?
Well, I think it was 2015.
It went into effect in February 2015, as I recall.
Yeah. So I guess two answers to that. Number one, Vermont, Madam Chair, Vermont is not a state that has legalized the possession of and the use of marijuana. So that is an exception to that rule. But if you're saying, did somebody commit then a second crime of possession of marijuana, perhaps once in 2012, hypothetically, and once in 2014, you know, 2015 is now 3 years ago. So at this point, we've 3 years where prior, if a person is using now, it's not against the law to use now, so it would be difficult for me to assign a criminal penalty or a penalty. I don't think I would be open to that, but I'm willing to sit down and talk with your office about that.
Okay, thank you. Any other members have any questions or comments before we go to public testimony? Senator Schauer.
Thank you. Welcome again. I think we saw this last year.
Good to see you.
So, repeat. The question I have, which I didn't think of last year, Senator Begich, just kind of curious how this would work. I know it was thought out and we discussed it, but if there was a plead down from a higher charge, and so what I'm asking, if I want to make sure I ask the question specifically and correctly, if in this case, since we're talking only this case as it is written, and in the case as it's taking place, they had a higher charge that was pled down to this, How does that work? In other words, we say, hey, it's just simple possession, got it, but it was pled down from something. That could be a way that almost seems like a loophole. That may not be the case, but I'd like to know how that works if there was something else going on that we have a – you see what I'm saying? So is there a way for somebody to get away with this that might have been doing something a little more than what it seems like on paper?
For the record, Sydney Linneman, through the chair, Senator Schauer, it is my understanding and through my discussions with the court system that whatever the final criminal record is how it is defined in their database. So even if they had started out with a couple of crimes and then pled down and the final version was just under this one statute, that would be removed from court view and from an interested party background check. Again, it would still remain in the system, so it would appear on most other higher level background checks, but not it would not appear on court view.
If I might add, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
I would add that again, as Ms. Linneman, Dr. Linneman indicated, the ability of a prosecutor to still get access to these records would not be impaired. They'd have access to the case file. They'd have access to all the information necessary. So that, I think, was what we talked about last year, Senator Schauer.
It was. One follow-up briefly for that.
Senator Schauer.
So with that as well, just and kind of a – and we don't have to do this now. I can come by and talk about it so we don't have other time. But talking about the rights of the employer, where you had mentioned before about, you know, kind of what's restricted and what isn't, I would just like to discuss that a little further because I'm getting other questions. So I'd know that, oh, yeah, I understand where it would be specifically applied to and where it would be excluded from, because obviously, as you mentioned, you know, Department of Transportation, other things, you want the ability of employers in certain fields to know that, you know, what they're getting for an employee, and some of that makes sense. But for other things, you know, clearly it doesn't. So thank you. I'll talk to you later for that.
Senator Michiki.
Just quickly, I'd like to put on the record, I think simple possession for someone making a simple mistake is one thing, but I think a long pattern of criminal, long history of criminal behavior is something else. I'd like to further develop that. Don't have to talk about it today, but I think if there's a long history of activity, I don't think any of it should be scrubbed. I think it demonstrates some judgment issues that a future employer may want to know about.
And that was the point of my first questioning as far as other history. And it looks like Senator Reinbold, did you?
I was just going to try to.
Madam Chair, may I just respond briefly to
Senator Begich.
To the chair, Senator Michiki, I think that's an appropriate comment, and I would entertain working with staff and with the senator, the Madam Chair, to do exactly that, to find a way to make it work.
Senator Reinbold.
Like I said, I wasn't going to say anything, but I would like to hear a perspective of, I don't know how many times they used before they got caught. I don't know how many were dismissed first before a conviction. It's kind of a lot. I mean, I don't know. Like I'm just echoing basically what Senator McTighe was saying. And also I'd like to look into what else, you know, if it's just marijuana, but I watched Mr. Duxbury on KTVA talking about in how many percentage of the cases marijuana is just one thing, but it really is a gateway to so much more. And I'm not an expert at all in this area, but I'd like to hear from him on his perspective in regards to this.
Okay, and we will take that under consideration. I wanted to mention, too, a couple other things I noticed in studying the bill in a question, and I believe we have a loophole problem with those that are 18, 19, 20, because marijuana is still not legal for them, and we could put ourselves in a position where we'd be violating the law as far as impunity for those in that age group. So I believe that needs to be addressed. The other thing in looking at the state job application, there is a section basically that a person could permanently lose eligibility for employment with the state of Alaska if they intentionally or unintentionally conceal or otherwise provide a false statement of material fact in an application submission. So we have to make sure we're not setting up a person to fail in that regard. So with those closing, that gives you something to think about, and we thank you for presenting today. We do have in the room, and these folks may be just here for questions. I'm thinking, and online, Catherine Monfreda, I believe it says Q under the word testimony instead of yes or no, and I'm guessing that's for questions. Do you have any comments, though, or anything that you might want to clarify?
No, I do not. I'm just available to answer questions.
Okay, thank you, Catherine. And just a reminder, we need to put our name on the record, even when I call you by name. So thank you for next time. And then also in the room, we have Kathleen McLaughlin. And she did say yes, she would like to provide testimony. So, Kathleen, please come forward.
Thank you. Just briefly.
And state your name for the record, please.
My name is Kathleen McLaughlin. I am the director of the Partners Reentry Center in Anchorage, Alaska. And I just wanted to make a couple comments to put this into perspective. We've served about 7,500 people in the last 5 years. Primarily, they're high-risk, high-needs, homeless individuals who would release to homelessness had we not stepped in our reentry program. This bill does not do something that I just want to make sure that everyone can understand. When we work with people who are reentrants with long histories, because we take the high-risk, high-needs individuals, their parole and probation conditions mandate that they not use marijuana as a condition. That still holds true. Whether it is legal or not legal in the state of Alaska, our high-risk, high-needs criminal reentrants must still not use marijuana as a condition of their probation and parole. So I just wanted to be clear on that. The other thing I just wanted to indicate is that my reading of this bill, it only impacts retroactively roughly 700 people. So it doesn't deal necessarily with the people that we are addressing in our criminal justice system today. An example that I wanted to give just briefly about 3 years ago, we were looking for somebody in the reentry community who was highly, highly, highly qualified. 10 years ago, she had a simple possession prior to going to college. That banned her from being able to be employed in this industry at that time. So when I look at that example, it causes me to think that that's the pocket of individuals that this particular legislation is supposed to be addressing, rather than the people in which we serve at the Reentry Center. And I can be available for any questions if anyone is interested.
Senator Reinbold.
Can you, high risk of what? I mean, people define high risk in so many different ways. So can you just say what you mean by high risk and high needs?
Sure, through the chair. Partners Reentry Center takes people who would otherwise release to homelessness, so their chances of recidivating are extraordinarily high. So what we take is, in the state of Alaska, we have a 66% recidivism rate. That 66% are the ones that we focus on to try to reduce recidivism and enhance public safety. So these are the individuals that have strong and lengthy continual felony and misdemeanor records. And we also use a tool called the LSIR. So if anyone has a score of 29 or more, they're considered high risk, high needs. And these are individuals that have criminal behaviors that cause a risk to the community when they release.
Kathleen, what does LSIR stand for?
It's the risk needs that's used by the Department of Corrections to determine whether someone is minimum, medium, or maximum risk-leveled individuals.
But you don't know what the acronym stands for? You can get back with us, that's fine.
Level, I will not be able to say what it is, but I can let you know.
Thank you. Senator Michicki.
Thank you for your comments. Is alcohol often also placed on conditions of release similar to the use of marijuana?
Through the chair, absolutely. It depends on what the underlying crimes are that will dictate what the court will order with regard to the probation and parole conditions.
Madam Chair.
I'll follow up. Senator Mitchell.
I asked that question because on the minor consuming of alcohol, you talked about the 18 to 20. We passed a bill a couple of years ago that deals with it a little differently. It's just something worth evaluating as we process this bill.
Okay, thank you. And a question, you mentioned 700 would be eligible, and that's statewide, correct?
What I was looking at was the attachments. I think that Nancy Mead did a survey of a ballpark number, and that was the 700 that I was referring to.
And then, you know, perhaps, and we can get this information maybe from Senator Begich and Sydney, if you'd provide it, of those 700, are those the ones that could have, as Senator Michicki and I are concerned about, other convictions, or they just only have the conviction of the simple marijuana possession? So, and Nancy could probably let us know that, too, but. Okay, thank you, thank you.
So just briefly, level of service inventory revised is the LSAR.
Very good.
That's pretty good.
That's good. Senator Schauer.
It's took me a while.
Just a little bit of a segue, I think, kind of summing up all of these, is some of the concern is obviously we have people that are higher risk that have a demonstrated behavior, and those are not the ones we're necessarily looking to clear here, if I use for lack of a better term, because those are ones that would present problems for employers, housing, other issues that you would want to know about. We don't want to prevent that. I think that's what I'm hearing is perhaps part of the concern. And the 700 we're talking about don't seem like they would fall under the category of who you're treating, because we're talking about hopefully no other issues. So it seems like we're almost talking apples and oranges here between the intent of this and what you're dealing with. Am I incorrect, or is that...
Through the chair, I totally agree. The individuals that we serve and the ones that work with the Reentry Center are none of them have just one.
I want to be clear for the record, and that was really it for the summation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's good to see you, too. And in the room, we also have Casey. She's here for questions. And is there any clarification, Casey, in the conversation that's gone on that you would like to come up and tell us? And members, a question for Casey? Because we are about at the hour, and so I want to thank Senator Begich and Sydney for coming today. And as I said earlier, we're going to set that bill aside, and so thank you. And are there any other comments from committee members? Okay, that concludes our business today. And the Senate Judiciary Committee meeting will be a joint meeting with the Senate State Affairs. Going to close public testimony. We're getting in the routine of things here yet. So, but the next meeting will be a joint one with Senate State Affairs next Tuesday, the 29th. At 3 p.m., and it will be up in the Senate Finance Committee room for the purposes of considering the governor's choice as the next Attorney General, Mr. Kevin Clarkson. So seeing no other business before the committee, we shall adjourn and let the record reflect that it's 3 o'clock on the nose.